From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And we do that in a lot of ways, but it's really centered around this idea of building a backyard advantage, which is to build the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. And it's based around this culture of love, helping one another. And it's happening, and that's what we're doing at the Growth Factory, right? We have funds, a venture fund that invest into local startups. We have local investors. We have local partners all working together. And when entrepreneurs win, it's really good for all of us. So that's what it's all about. And that's kind of the main reason I started this show is, look, I want to help provide information and communication back to the entrepreneurial community so that they can be a little bit more connected, a little bit more inspired, and definitely educated. So today on the show, we have Brad Frisk. He is the founder and CEO of Cypress Creek Capital Group. You're also a consultant with Raymond James. Mm-hmm. So you have this incredible, I guess, background in the world of finance. And that's really what we're going to talk about today is three of my favorite subjects. First, fatherhood. Second, finance. Well, we're always talking about, you know, how to deal with the complexities around finance and how important that is, especially if you're an entrepreneur or an entrepreneur that maybe sells his company and you're an expert in that realm. But then also talk a little bit about patriotism and the American dream and why we love this country. So with that said, Brad, welcome for the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you've been on the show, I think it was earlier this year, and we talked a little bit about markets and a little bit about how to sell your company. So maybe just from an overview of your background for somebody who doesn't know you yet.
Yeah, I've been in finance for almost 20 years. Kind of grew up in a family that came with CPAs and financial planners, and so I was around it a lot. At one point, my grandfather wanted to pass his business to me, but he said, hey, you have to get a job at a bank and you have to get your licensing. You kind of have to work your way up. So
what was his occupation? He was an accountant?
Yeah, he was a CPA. Okay. So he had his own CPA practice in Walnut Creek. And then he was also a certified financial planner and was independent. So he was self-employed as well. And it was great. It kind of led me to getting into banking. I worked with Chase. You know, got into business banking, commercial banking. I was the top commercial banker in San Francisco, in California, for a couple of years in a row.
Oh my goodness!
In San Francisco, yeah, and it was great. I actually had a client of mine sit me down over a beer and say, "Hey, you're good at what you do. I think you might be in the wrong line of business." And so, you know, he made some connections for me with some guys at Morgan Stanley in Menlo Park. Sand Hill Road office, which is a lot of activity there, a lot of complexity. Yeah. More private capital, venture capital money than anywhere in the world. And so I did that. And it was really where I was first kind of introduced to investment banking mixed with private wealth management, which was kind of the inception point for where I am today. So yeah, and that's what we do now. We help business owners who are looking to sell their company. We specialize in kind of, you know, taking them through that process. And then at the same time, introduce strategies that reduce taxation and help them think about life after the sale and kind of build the picture of what's life look like after being an entrepreneur.
Okay. I look forward to diving in with that a little bit further in the show. But first, I'd like to talk a little bit about your experience as a dad. You are the father of three.
Yep.
And you've got kids spread out from 8 to 15. And I have to imagine that's got to be one of the things that brings you the most joy in life.
I mean, without question, like being a father is the most rewarding and challenging thing that has occurred in my life to date.
Okay, let's talk about the rewards and then let's talk about the challenges. That's good. So what do you love most about being a dad?
I mean, I love that I can come home every day and my kids are there just to accept me for who I am, right? I love that I can always be myself around my kids. I never have to adapt right, to the environment.
They know the real you.
Yeah, I think they know the real me more than anybody. So I love that. I love that there's just this embedded trust with your kids that, in my opinion, it just doesn't come easily with people that you meet outside of your family, right? You have to kind of build that trust. And so, and not to say that you don't need to build it with your kids. I think that's really important, but I think that it's there. It's kind of yours to mess up with kids, right? Like, they trust you. They love you. And as long as you're being a good steward of that, it's a great relationship. So I love it. I love, you know, one-on-one time with my kids. I love, you know, getting the full family out. We love to travel, all kinds of different activities.
Well, you're a busy guy. How do you find a way to get one-on-one time in a family of five?
I mean, it's extremely challenging. I describe to people, in fact, I was just having lunch or dinner with Jack Crawford, who I think you know, and we were talking about this topic. We had just played golf with our two boys. And I was telling him that, you know, when I think about my life, it's faith, family, business, and health and fitness. Like, those are the four cups that I'm constantly focusing on. And at any given moment, it feels like I can have two or three of them pretty full, but the other one is just empty. Like, it's just, you can't seem to get them all full at the same time. It's something that I talked about a lot within, like, my EO forums and other people that I trust and respect. But what we noticed, I think this is shortly after COVID, and I say we, my wife and I, we noticed that our kids really benefited when they got kind of pulled aside to just do one-on-one time. And maybe that's a date, maybe that's a trip, but the bond that you build when you just kind of get them out of the environment of, you know, the home and the siblings, and you're just focusing on them, it just changes something. I don't know what it is. In fact, I just did this with my middle son, Everett. He's 11. And, you know, a few years ago, he was diagnosed with ADD and ADHD, and he's a total sweetheart and a great kid. But there are times where, you know, he just needs his own time, and he's very affectionate. And so I think it was 2 weeks ago, we drove up to Gray Eagle, and my brother has a house up there, and we stayed overnight, and we went fishing and we went golfing, right? Golfing barefoot.
Oh, nice.
And the change after is, you cannot deny the change in his personality, his willingness to be kind to his brothers and sisters.
You saw a change after that?
Absolutely.
Outing? Yeah. Or that weekend or whatever it was?
Absolutely. And it doesn't even have to be that, at least for us. My wife and I made an agreement to once a month take a child out and go do a date. Mm-hmm. And the other parent will watch the other two kids. So my wife did this really cool thing with my older son, where they went to the mall and they were both given a budget and they split up. It was like, all right, you go buy me my stuff. I'm going to go buy you your stuff. And they came together and exchanged it. And it's just, I think it's that type of creativity.
That is creative. Okay, so let me walk through this. So you got a 15, was it the 15 and the 11-year-old? Was it the two older?
Yeah, my 15-year-old son, yeah. Braden, my 11-year-old son, Everett, and then my daughter is Ellison.
Okay, so the two boys each got a certain amount of money. And how much was it?
No, so my wife took just my son. So the way that we approach this is one-on-one.
Okay.
Right? This is one-on-one time. It's dedicated time. You guys kind of figure out what you want to do and you go do it. I think that it was like $100 each or something like that. So, you know,
so your wife
nothing
was
crazy.
With your son while he's doing the shopping.
Exactly. Okay. So my wife and my son go on, you know, effectively a date.
Okay.
And decide what they want to do. And so this time they decided, let's go to the mall. You get $100 to spend, I get $100 to spend, but we have to spend it on things for the other person. And so it was really cool. It was really fun. But again, I think that, look, I think with fatherhood and parenting, like, nobody is the foremost expert, right? Like, you're just trying to do the best job you can. I think today with kids, you have to get really creative and kind of outthink the situation. And so we try to do that as best we can. But getting back to your question, how do I find the time? It's that cup analogy, right? I may be able to find the time to do that consistently with my kids, and then I get pulled away for a month or 2 months. And then I have to come back to it, right? So it's kind of the continuing to get back to it that I think creates that that value.
In terms of like the biggest challenges, I think about that a lot because I see I've got 7 grandkids, different ages, up to 15, from like 2 to 15. And then I think back to my kids who are now like 38 and 40, and the challenges that today's young people face are similar in many ways to what they faced, my kids faced, 20 years ago, and somewhat similar to what I faced when I was a kid, but in some ways they're different, right? We don't have some of the same things, and one of those is the technology. And so I constantly think about, is this technology overall good or bad? It's certainly a challenge to figure out the right way to help moderate that so they get the most out of the technology instead of it becoming, I guess, harmful in some way or the biggest distraction in their life so they don't get their regular work done.
Yeah, this is a hot button topic for me. So when I was a kid, I had friends and they played video games and they loved it and they would do tournaments and, play Madden. And it was never my thing. So like, I remember going over to a friend's house and there was maybe 7 or 8 buddies there and they're all playing Madden, video games, and I'm out front shooting hoops. And so very early on, we established with our kids that video games are just not a thing here.
Oh, like, interesting.
You have no access to video games. We're not buying any kind of Super Nintendos or anything like that.
Zero. And it's still in effect.
Still in effect.
And are you happy? Obviously, it's still in effect, so you're happy with that decision. What are the, negative consequences associated with that decision?
I honestly don't think that there are any negatives. I mean, maybe from their perspective, a negative might be that they're missing out on maybe some connection with friends on a topic, in discussion at school. But none of my kids have ever complained about it or said that it's a big deal to them. I think that the fact that we just abstained from it very early was very helpful. However, my kids did get access to phones through grandparents at a pretty young age, and that is a struggle. It's always been a struggle. I think that just the ease of the addiction to this device and the dopamine hits that they get through it and watching YouTube videos and having access to information that is really not meant for kids, it's terrifying. It really bothers me. I have not figured it out.
Okay.
I'm looking for more solutions on it, but.
So this is basically the grandparents' fault, sounds like.
100%. Yeah. 100%.
What happened? They decided, these kids, a Christmas gift and you could have a phone?
No, it was I'm not going to name names here, but they know who they are. They basically gave my oldest son one of their old iPhones.
Oh, okay. And how old was he at that time?
Maybe 8 or 9.
Oh, he was a pretty young guy.
Yeah. But it didn't have any connectivity to the internet. It was like they couldn't use it to call anybody. It was more at that time just for taking photos. My oldest son was into photography. Mm-hmm. But it evolved right into, hey, let me play Roblox on it, or let me do this, let me do that. It's just kind of been this. It's just been this present thing in our lives.
Roblox is a video game, though, right? So video games okay? No, they're not. They're not okay.
No,
okay.
No, we keep them away from video games as much as possible. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that they haven't probably played video games, right? Being realistic, I'm sure they have. For me, it's the addiction. Mm-hmm. It is really the addiction to the technology, whether it's YouTube videos or even TV or, video games. I just don't want them to be consumed by something for hours upon hours of their day. In fact, to leave my house and come here, my 8-year-old daughter, who had just done swim practice, back on the chair. She's, two days into her summer vacation, watching TV. And I looked at her and said, hey, you're not going to be sitting on that chair watching TV all summer. You better figure out what you want to do. And so some of the ideas that we've brought up are let's get you lessons, guitar lessons. My middle son, We just watched a show called Queen's Gambit. He's really into chess. Mm-hmm.
That's good.
And so I've told him, hey, you want access to the iPad? You can have access to the iPad to learn chess. You want to make money? Read a book. I'll pay you to read the book. Read a book on chess. We kind of use those types of things to motivate our kids, right? If they're asking for money and they want to do chores, no. But if you read a book or if you learn this AI class, we'll pay them for that kind of stuff.
Interesting. So what about goal setting? I often think that, especially in your line of work, you're helping people come to grips with what their life goals might be so that from a financial standpoint, maybe even beyond the financial, but now you do that professionally for a living. How does that work in terms of getting your children to be more goal oriented?
Yeah. I'll give you an example. With our oldest son who is just going into his freshman year, I was in New York on client meetings, I guess it was almost a month ago now, and I flew him and my wife out for the second half of the trip. And we went and we toured NYU, and then we took the train to New Haven and we toured Yale. He's nowhere near the age to where he should be thinking about these colleges. I mean, he should be aware of these opportunities, but we're trying to help him set a goal based off of something that he sees and he experiences. I think the approach here is, let's tour some schools. Let's find something that he experiences and says, Dad, I don't care what it takes. I have to go to this school. And so he's driving the goal. He's setting it. It's really something that is moving forward based off of his interests. We really don't try to place big goals on our kids. We're more of a, let's show you a nice carrot to go after, right? We pay for grades. We don't pay allowance, right? Everything is really kind of dictated towards if you're interested in earning money, I'm going to show you the ways that you can earn money, and I'm going to align it with the goals and values that we're hoping you'll follow. He also started an entrepreneurs club at his high school, nice. Whitney High School, which came from Jack Crawford as mm-hmm. well. And so I paid him for that. I said, hey, based off of your effort, I will pay you for your time to do that. I think that we're trying to be very creative in the way that we think about motivating our kids while also being very aware of the pressure that comes with setting goals and pushing for goals.
It's interesting because I'm thinking about this a little bit. I'm coaching eighth grade tackle football for the Del Oro.
Oh man, sports have gotten crazy.
Yeah, and it's really competitive to be a top level athlete at the high school level, to be a starter on the varsity team.
Yeah,
it actually takes a significant commitment to get in and play college sports. A lot of people are thinking about becoming college athletes, and that's extremely difficult. It depends on what your ability level is, but more than that, I think it depends on what your daily habits are and what you do all day in order to move in the right direction. So one of the things that I saw growing up, and I saw it with myself and with my kids, is when the goal is big enough and a really difficult thing to achieve, there's a little bit more motivation that comes with that because you know how hard it is to become that. But when you set a goal lower, you know, you don't really feel like you have to put in the extra work. And what I found for me is an insane amount of extra work was the difference, right? Yeah. It was when I went like crazy, using a crazy amount of imagination to do everything possible to figure it out, that's when my advancements happen. And so I used to do this sort of exercise with my brother, who's my business partner from the time we were like 10 years old, set these kind of outlandish goals. And then we would do this exercise where it would be like, okay, we have to do everything possible. Now we use something that I don't recommend for you guys out there, but we called it it was the everything possible exercise. We talked about a gun to your head, mm-hmm. right? So it's better. Like if you have a gun to your head, if you don't reach the goal, what would you do? Right. You're like, oh, yeah. You will like your imagination goes off the charts on what you're going to do if you know that you're going to get shot. Yeah. But let's call it $1 billion to make it more positive.
I can relate. I mean, yeah. At our swim meets, I tell my kids, like, there's a shark at your feet, right?
Yeah,
like,
shark at your feet, yeah. But if you win this race, or if you get to the next level, like, let's call it varsity, then you get $1 billion. Okay. And if you can really get yourself imagining that, you get yourself thinking it actually, you're picturing what it would be like to have that, to be bathing in that $1 billion, your habits change. If you can really get yourself kind of believing it, mm-hmm. then you will start imagining different ways to get better. And you don't need a parent or a coach yelling at you and prompting you to get outside and do your exercises or whatever it is. It's like, you get insane about the kind of effort that you will put in.
Yeah, I think my view differs just slightly from yours. I think that sometimes, and let's be clear, I set a goal to basically change my successful practice into a West Coast business, right? So my goal is to have offices in Seattle, Orange County, and San Diego within the next 5 years, if I can. It's a massive goal, right?
Yeah.
If I fall short and I get one new office, like, that's still making some very, very significant and meaningful progress. But I also think that if you set goals that are so big, it can become overwhelming, right? It can feel unattainable. I think that the trick is to set that big, massive, that BHAG, right? Like, that mm-hmm. big goal.
Yeah.
But at the same time, implement milestones, because I think that there is a ton to be said for momentum. I think that little achievements along the way build up your confidence, build up your momentum, kind of make the next goal more attainable. And before you know it, like, you're kind of approaching this big goal. So that's really, you know, if one of my kids sat me down and said, "Hey, Dad, like, how should I be thinking about this?" I would say, "Dude, I mean, like, you like basketball? NBA is your goal. Like, shoot for the NBA. But in the meantime, try to have your best scoring game. And then, you know, try to be on a team that wins first place. Like, let's take incremental goals along
that.
The way.
I love that. And that's what we did as well, because you're not going to get straight to... We didn't reach a lot of our goals, okay?
Yeah.
But we set shorter-term milestones, knowing that there would be a pathway to this. And so we put the milestone goal that maybe is not as sexy, but you still picture the $1 billion, right? You still picture, oh, I got to get to, that's a gettable thing. Okay, I can get the milestone. But you put the fantasy world of, you know, the billion, bathing in the $1 billion up against a achievable milestone. Mm-hmm. And so it still changes your behavior and your creativity to get to this basic milestone.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to sell yourself short.
Yeah.
Right? I think that it's very common for people to reduce themselves, right? They put caps on who they can be mentally. I think that they can oftentimes imagine that, you know, I can only go so far, or I am only so good. But I honestly think that, you know, those bigger goals and having that optimism and vision to be able to go past that, like, it can get you there, right? You don't want to be the one who's limiting yourself based off of your own internal thinking.
Yeah, well, I mean, most of society does that. Let's face it. Yeah. The people that you work with on a regular basis are high achievers. They've done things that they're the 1%, let's call it, the 2%. They're up there, and it's because of the amount of creativity and work and
grit,
things like that. Yeah, grit, perseverance, picking themselves back up, that kind of stuff got them there. And most people don't really imagine themselves in that realm. Yeah. I just hope I get a good job or whatever, pay the bills.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's a blend of dream big, set big goals, and be realistic about the pathway it takes to get there. Don't get too hard on yourself, right? Like, give yourself a break. Everybody screws up. Just get back on the horse and keep going. Perseverance, just like you said. Like, the ability to just keep pushing even after setbacks.
Have you seen your kids fail? Like, how do you...
Kids don't fail, Mark. I'm sorry.
how do they deal with failure today? Are they healthy in the way they deal with the failure?
I would say it depends on the activity. I think that with sports, there's, it feels like sports, there's a lot more pressure today than there was when we were kids. And so I feel like with sports, they have more of a, they get pretty down on themselves if they're not doing well. So that's something that like we're aware of, right? And we talk them through, hey, it's okay, like as long as you keep trying. But I think that, honestly, I think kids have a lot of pressure on them today for school, for sports, for like their social circles. I think that parents, I mean, the way I was raised was, you know, hand and fist, like, you know, you do it, don't argue. It was very strict. It was very like my way or the highway. And I think that now maybe you can, I think it's more challenging to take that route. I think it is a lot more of kind of coaching them, being their coach through those moments, and making sure that they're continuing to grow. And yeah, I mean, specifically to sports, like we've had almost all of our kids at one point or another have said, I want to quit this sport. We don't let them quit, right? We let them quit at the end of the season if they want to. We're maybe disappointed in it because we were hoping that that would be their sport. They showed some passion in it at some point, which is why they were doing it in the first place. But they have to finish the season. And I remember one time I had a conversation with my two sons who both wanted to quit baseball, which was heartbreaking for me, right? I love baseball, big Giants fan. I played baseball for years. And so I remember driving down Stanford Ranch in Rockland. I said, all right, guys, here's the deal. You tell me what you want to do, and I don't care what it is. Like, if you want to do tennis, if you want to do golf, if you want to do music, if you want to do swim, you guys tell me what you want to do, because you're going to be great at what you have passion in. That is the first thing that you need, is to have passion in what you're doing. And they both were like, swim. We want to do swim. And I instantly turned to them and said, look, swim is not like jackknives and cannonballs. Okay. Like, it's hard work. Every sport at some point is going to get tough. There's going to be a point where you want to quit. You have to find something that you love enough to push through that moment and keep going. So it was a fun conversation. They never got back to baseball. They both did swim. They loved it. My middle son is still doing swim, doing pretty well.
When I failed, I can think back to a couple of times when I failed in sports as a youngster. In baseball, I thought I was going to make All-Stars one year, and they were announcing all the players, and I was kind of figured I'd make it no problem. Even mm-hmm. though it was very competitive, I figured I was pretty good. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get my name didn't get called. And so we were out at Roseville High School, and I just started running around the track. Next thing you know, I'm running home, and I feel like I've been running ever since. It made me, you know, I made All-Stars after that. I think the next time you can make All-Stars was 15. And so we made it. We had a really good team. But in football, one year when I was in eighth grade, I got injured. And so what do I do with the injury? It was an injury to my shoulder running through the line. I was a running back. And I was like, oh, man. And I was kind of like, I had the really flimsy shoulder pads because I wanted to be able to catch the ball, get my arms over my head and all that kind of stuff. And so what I did, I kept going to practice, even though it was just excruciating pain on my shoulder. I kept going to practice and I ran bleachers. And that was the year I got faster. And so it was interesting how I turned a setback. And then I just ran bleachers while other people practiced, you know, did the regular practice. I ran bleachers and I just did it to, you know, stay busy, I guess. Found myself getting faster. By the end of the year, I was like maybe the fastest kid on the team. And then I was fast in high school and so on. So it's interesting to think about how you can be defeated by things and quit or turn it around for something that, you know, you can work on one of your other weaknesses if you've got, you know, if something happens to you like that.
Yeah, I think the key is to like make that decision to not let it defeat you, right? To leverage the experience. I'm laughing because I had a very similar story in eighth grade. I think I weighed like 90 pounds, right? I was very, very light. All of my friends were on the Pop Warner Cougars, right? Which was like the eighth grade team. But I wasn't heavy enough. So I was on the Cubs. So I was playing with kids a little bit younger than me. And I was doing great. And so finally they said, hey, let's move you up to the Cougars, right? Well, on the Cubs, I was a running back. I was a linebacker. I was the big kid. So I remember going to the Cougars coach, who was a friend of my dad's, and he said, "Frisky, what position do you play?" I was like, "I play tailback and I play linebacker." He's like, "All right, get in there and give me a 32 dive. No problem." I get in there. I go to the two hole. My fullback goes to the one and doesn't go to the right hole. I have no blocker. I go through, and on the other side of this line is this guy, Tosh Burris. I think he went to UNLV on a full scholarship. This dude looked like he was 20 years old. Massive athlete, basketball, track, everything, and crushed me, bruised my ribs. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't practice. I could barely walk. What ended up happening was I was sidelined for so long that I said, "You know what? Can I just go back to the Cubs?" And so they allowed me to go back to the Cubs. And I went back to playing football, and it was honestly one of my most memorable seasons. We were not a good team. In fact, we played in the, what they called the Toilet Bowl in Petaluma, which were like the two last place teams. But I will never forget that game, like the number of sacks that I had, the number of tackles, the touchdowns. I mean, that never would have happened if I would have just given up after that experience with the Cougars. But it was,
so that's the lesson on that one is, yeah, dude, Burris can't make me quit.
Yeah. Yeah. More than one way to skin a cat. I still had a lot of fun. You know, I grew through my eighth grade and freshman year. Really for the rest of high school, I got into football and I did okay. You know, I wasn't getting scholarships, but I was, I'd say, above average.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So one last thing on fatherhood. What's the role of the grandparents? It sounds like part of it is giving the phones away to the grandkids, but like, what are they, if you were a grandfather or maybe you were to set an expectation, because that's the stage I'm at now. I have seven grandkids, and so I've got my own views on what a grandfather or a grandmother can be. How do you see that? Do you have expectations for yourself as a potential grandparent, or, you know, you sounds like you've got grandparents in your kids' life that are very into helping their grandkids.
Yeah, so I have a very unique kind of view on this topic, and I it's going to sound like I'm bashing my parents. I'm not. But my parents are really just not around very much, right? There's some reasons they're not around. I have a great relationship with both of them, but my dad lives pretty far away, and he's just not the guy that you would call to say, "Hey, can you babysit the kids?" Oh. Right? He's taken us on trips, and you know, he finds his way to get time with our kids, but it's not a regular occurrence in our lives. My wife's parents could not be more opposite. So I get to see their involvement in our kids, and really, for the longest time, and maybe even still today, my father-in-law Victor, he was my kid's best friend. He's always there for them. In fact, he just took my son Everett to his dive practice today because I had to be here. They are willing to do anything they can to help out, and they're retired now. But even when they weren't retired, if they had the ability to do it, they would do it. My mother-in-law, basically, like, her whole career was watching kids from home, and so they watched our kids. They really have been, you know, woven into the fabric of our family, for better or for worse, from a very, very early stage. And so I think that is kind of the standard for me as I think about my kids and my relationship with them, and someday hopefully having grandkids. I want to be present in those relationships, right? I want to have involvement, obviously respect the boundaries, but I think that the grandparents just offer this very unique relationship where, you know, they're wise. There's a little bit of, you know, education and coaching and definitely a great amount of love, but also like this level of fun that you really can't have with your parents, right? Because your parents kind of have to be that, like, yeah, this is how it is. And the grandparents don't have to do that, right? The grandparents can be the, "Hey, I am your dad's dad. I'll tell you what we're going to go do." All right. So they could kind of override, and there's not much you can say about it. But
my wife retired from the city of Roseville, I think at 47, because we had grandkids. My daughter was pregnant, and she's like, I'm not doing this. So she took like an early retirement from the city, you know, great job. And all that. But no, I'm not doing it. And we were in a position where she could do that. And since then, she's been calling herself like a stay-at-home grandmother. So I got back from Tahoe probably about 90 minutes ago. We went there for our 41st anniversary and came back. And when I left to come here for the show, we had two grandkids over there, the two little ones, the 2 and the 3-year-old, playing with my wife and at the house. To me, the grandmother can be this magnet, and at least that's the way it is in my family. Is like my wife is sort of a magnet to the kids, and then I'm sort of I'm like a football coach guy. I'm driving over here, and my daughter and son-in-law text me and say, "Hey, here's Rocco's goals for the summer for baseball. Can you work with him on grounders and batting practice or lifting in the gym?" So we're getting this daily communication of how to be involved in their lives. I mean, it is a constant flow that, to me, it's like a great reason to stay alive,
Yeah, but I don't think that opportunity is there for you if you don't first have a great relationship with your kids, right? You need to have a healthy relationship with your kids to kind of get that access to really be around your grandkids a lot. So I think you're kind of paving the way early on, what is your experience with your grandchildren look like? I think that it probably starts with building a good relationship with your kids, but
yeah, I think you're right. And the proximity is such a big deal too. So
yeah,
I think it's kind of, you hear about people that are going to move out of state and that kind of thing for the tax purposes and things. But you think about the friends and family, the network you have, the people that love you the most, you're leaving them to go make new. So it is kind of a interesting decision as to how to put yourself in proximity to the people you care about most.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, look what you're doing here at the Growth Factory. It's built off of community, right? Look at your faith, right? Whatever religion it might be, it's built off of community. I think your family is the same way, right? You need to have a community there. You need to have a village. It can only benefit your kids, right? Exposing them to different people with different characteristics, I think it's very valuable. But I also think it's very difficult, right? There's lot of challenging family dynamics. And I don't think that kids are even aware of it, right? I was never aware of it when I was a kid. But as you get older, you realize, oh gosh, yeah, things can go wrong pretty easily if you're not really putting an effort in with your family. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's definitely a challenge, I think, with the family dynamics associated with your kids, and they need their independence at some point. Mm-hmm. And so the further away the more independent that they get, a lot of times barriers build up and, it can drive wedges and that kind of thing. So, yeah, we are lucky that we've overcome some of those barriers. And again, I think it has to do with communication and giving a little more than you take if you can.
There was a point a few years back where I approached my wife, and the way I remember the story was I basically approached her and said, "Hey, I think that we should stop taking vacations." And she looked at me like I'd lost it. Like she thought I was nuts. And I went on to say, I think that we're not getting as much value out of our time with our kids by doing a weekend in Tahoe, a weekend in San Diego, Disneyland. And so I had basically built this proposal and walked her through what we spend on a trip to Disneyland. And it was $14,000, right? 5 people, flights for 5, hotel, 3 meals out for 5 people, park passes, whole thing.
Yeah, I know. It's insane.
It's so expensive. And then I showed her this Airbnb that was actually a friend of a friend in Poipu, Kauai. And for a full month, it was $14,000. And so I said, think about the time that we spend with our kids at Disneyland. It is, in our business, we call it volatility. It is a peak followed by a valley. I'm on a ride, I'm on a peak. I'm in line for an hour, I'm in a valley. And it's just that over and over again. And 3 days later, have we really created any memories? And so we did it. We went to Kauai. We were there for a month. It was not a vacation. It was a relocation. I still worked. My wife still had to work at points. But I will tell you, our kids told us it was the best thing that we ever could have done. the bonding between our kids, the bonding between us and our kids.
Because you're all, they don't have any other friends or outside distractions.
Yeah,
so
you're
kind
of taking that stuff out of the scenario. You're removing them from what they know, right? And what's familiar. And so we're in a place we've never been before. And we need to come together to experience it. And I'm telling you, it is gold. It is a golden experience. If anyone has the opportunity to do it, I highly recommend it.
Well, there's one thing that I think people, everybody wants to have a close family, but if you can have a family that is close for multiple generations, it can be like a big advantage for you. You can be, you're stronger as any one of you is stronger because you've got the other 13, 15, 25 people in your tribe that would do anything for you.
Yeah.
It is, I mean, it's kind of an overlooked potential asset for people. And they just go, I can kind of go my own way, whatever, whatever. But no, it is, it can become so valuable.
So that statement kind of bleeds into what we do with clients, right? Like take, for example, if we have a client who has highly appreciated shares of some stock and it's in a taxable account, we'll ask them, you know, how is your relationship with your parents? Because they can pass that ass on to their parents. Upon passing, they get a step up in basis. If it comes back to them, they now have a tax-free asset, right? Mm-hmm. Or same thing with 529 plans. If I create a 529 plan for my son, well, that's going to be on our FAFSA application, our free application for federal student aid. But if I have my parents do it, it's off the application, so we'll qualify for more student aid. So there are financial benefits to having parents that you can trust and are active in your lifestyle.
Okay, so let's pivot a little bit then. Yeah. Let's talk about, you know, the second topic was going to be finance, and I could, you know, hit you with 1,000 questions, but the one that just prompted in my mind based upon when you said the 529 plans, what about these Trump accounts? I've heard these Trump accounts, is now the time to go set up a Trump account?
It depends on the age of your child, right? I think it's kids born, and don't quote me on this, between I think 2025 and 2028. I believe they get $1,000 in government funding.
Okay.
If your kids are born outside of those years, you can still participate in it. But it really just acts like a tax deferred growth vehicle. You can still accomplish some of those same things by doing a 529 plan. Even if you're self-employed, you know, potentially a Roth account, if you're able to find some way to pay them. But I think it's great. I think there's a big issue, especially with our young people today, with finding the effort that it takes to save for your future. It is becoming more and more apparent that they're just not interested in doing it, right?
Why is that? Okay, so when I was a kid, you know, my first job was my brother and I cracked walnuts and sold them in little baggies door to door. We mowed lawns.
Yep.
Eventually got the paper route. And we were always setting some amount of money aside because my older brother, he was kind of a miser type guy. He saved, save, save. I liked having enough money to go do what I want. I like to spend money. So it was for different reasons, but we always saved money. There was always a goal of building.
I think it's an issue with, it's a lot of different things, right? Let's be clear about that. But the first things that come to my mind are just the consumption society that we've built, right? I mean, in 2 seconds, I can pick up this phone and I can buy something. If I need to have something delivered from Target, it can be delivered in just a matter of hours, right? So I think that we're kind of, especially as technology evolves, we're cultivating this society of, hey, if I want it, I can just go buy it.
And do you see, I was going to, sorry to interrupt you, but yeah. Do you see us wanting to keep up with the Joneses more because we see other people on Instagram or something else that are appearing to live this really cool lifestyle? And it's like, well, I want to have that too because I see other people showing off their Disneyland pictures.
I do. And it's because of the word use, I see it. Right. They're now able to see people through their Instagram, their Facebook, whatever social media aspect they have and they use. I mean, think about what 30 years ago or however long ago you want to look, when those things weren't around, it was just the people in your immediate network. Right. What is my neighbor doing? What is my cousin doing? now you have like insight into the whole world. Like, how are these celebrities living? How are these successful people living? I want that. I think it's got a little bit of an ongoing issue that we're going to have to deal with.
Interesting. So you deal with high net worth, maybe multi-generational type of wealth that's the hope. That's some of the goal, but financial literacy is a big piece of it. And I have to imagine the earlier that financial literacy begins, the better off that this family has, a better chance they're going to have of maintaining some of that wealth.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Obviously, I mean, if you run any kind of a calculation based off the time value of money, the earlier you start, the easier it is to be successful later in retirement. But I also think that like there are challenges that come with that. So it just really kind of depends on like how you approach it, I would say.
Yeah. Okay, so you help people as they're thinking about exiting their business. Mm-hmm. Okay, so these are people that are highly successful. They have built something that has got enough value where somebody might actually want to buy it, which is really amazing. Difficult to do. Yeah, it sounds like it would be easy. Trust me, it's not. But if you're fortunate enough to do that, you want to go through it thoughtfully in the way that you sell your company so that you're able to extract some of that wealth that's built into your business. It's usually like a big part of our net worth is tied up in our business if you're building a business. So you want to make sure that you make the decisions correctly so that you don't have to give a bunch of it to the government, and that when after you're done, you're preserving that wealth or growing that wealth.
Yep.
Okay. I know that's a lot, but like when in the earlier stages before you sell your company, what should you be doing to, I guess, get your mind right and get some of the things done in advance before selling the company?
I think the biggest area of opportunity for entrepreneurs is to just find people to put on their team, right? I think that they're very reluctant to engage with professionals early, maybe for a number of different reasons. Maybe they like don't want to be sold, right? They're fearful mm-hmm. that, hey, if I reach out to this person, they're going to try to sell me something. They're going to pressure me into something. But the opportunity there, in my opinion, the early opportunity is to get to know an advisor, get to know somebody who's a specialist in tax, whether it's a CPA or an attorney, find an attorney, a business attorney, an M&A attorney, and just start to get to know them, because those people are going to be there to help you through a very highly complex process. It is imperative that you have trust. And trust takes time. So, I think that there's a lot of opportunity for them just to start to network with those professionals that could be there to help them and educate them too.
Yeah, and I imagine this is one of the things I see in the entrepreneurs organization is there are people in the entrepreneurs organization that have built and sold companies. There mm-hmm. are people like yourself who understand these processes. And there's no dumb questions when you're an EO. When you're among your peers, you've all built businesses.
Yeah.
One person just might know more about how to sell a business. And it is a place that you can go just to ask dumb questions because you're not sure. And have somebody break down the basics for you from people who have, you know, been there, done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I'm an EO Sacramento. I sponsor EO SF. And it is that community that you can kind of just come and bear all, which I think is really valuable. But outside of entrepreneurship, you know, you really don't have that kind of community. I think that that's not as readily available. I think entrepreneurs do a good job of kind of coming around and supporting each other once they commit to it. But, you know, a lot of those really complex questions on tax, legal, wealth, investment, a lot of those are something that you need to outsource to somebody who's really in there living and breathing it every single day. I love EO. I love my chapter mates. I think that they all have a very unique story. I'm always impressed anytime I have a conversation with one of them. So I'm thankful for that community. I know you are too.
Okay. So build a team. Obviously that's important. You need mm-hmm. to have people who know how to help you through the process. And I have to, what else is there in terms of a key? Is there like one piece of advice besides building a team that would be, you got to do this?
Well, there are a couple like very hot topics right now. I think one is QSBS, right? Qualified Small Business Stock, Section 1202 stock, whatever you want to call it. It was recently modified. It used to be $10 million in tax benefit. It was increased up to $15 million. This is specific to C corps in certain industries, so it doesn't apply to like service industries like mine or
QSBS. It's interesting because there are it's obviously it's gotten improved, right? You basically defer tax on the first $15 million, but there are people that are developing multi trust type of scenarios where they're let's say you sold for $100 million.
You can stack it.
You can stack different if you have people you trust and get some different ownership, you can stack those benefits.
Yeah, you can stack it. You also have access to 50% of the benefit after 3 years and 75% of the benefit after 4 years, which is kind of nice, right? A 5 year holding period can be a long time to wait. But no, if your spouse owns shares, if you have two kids and they own shares, you can stack $60 million in federal tax benefit. The states treat it differently. Some states recognize it, other states don't. But I think the key is, and this kind of goes back to your questions on what we can plan for early, you can reassign shares into these trusts while your share value is very low. You have that ability to do that. It can grow within that trust to whatever it grows to, right? So if you want to move shares early before your share price pops, like you could multiply that benefit even more.
It's interesting because back when I first started my companies 20, 30 years ago, we were told before QSBS became a thing, your tax advisor is going to tell you to start an S corp typically, maybe an LLC, something like that. But because these are pass-through type of businesses. But nowadays, if somebody's thinking about a startup or building a business, even if it's, they don't really know if they're going to sell it down the road, they just want something for, you know, to feed the family. Should they start a C corp?
I think it's a conversation to have with your tax advisor, right? And with yourself. Like, what are your plans for the business? Are you thinking that you're going to exit at some point? I would also keep in mind that your buyer, you know, of your company will look at an S corp very differently than they look at a C corp, right? The C corp comes with some depreciation benefits that your S corp doesn't. So a stock sale versus an asset sale kind of comes into play. But yeah, I think that those are conversations that you at least need to be educating yourself on, because who knows where your company is going to go? Who knows, you know, how you're going to evolve your thinking? And, you know, maybe you just want to stick in the company and pass it on through your kids. But educating yourself will give you a leg up for sure. Another hot topic that I want to bring up is ESOPs. ESOPs are something that we're looking very closely at right now. We just did a presentation to EOSF on exiting using an ESOP. Employee stock ownership plan. If you have employees that you want to pass your business on to, there can be tremendous tax benefit in that. But you need to have a management and an executive team that you can kind of pass the torch to, right? So you can sell part of your business to your employees. You can sell the full thing to your employees, but there are some great, great benefits tax-wise.
So let's talk about the ESOP a little bit. I wasn't necessarily expecting to talk about that, but your employees... You get a valuation from a bank, and the employees basically borrow the money to buy you out. And then tell me about these tax benefits. How do you get out of paying money to the IRS?
So you can extract money through the payment, right? It's basically a loan using a 1042 strategy and not pay tax on it really ever, right? Ever. But it gives you the ability to access the equity in your company. And again, partial or full, and really kind of bypass the taxation because the company is still living on through your employees.
But the underwriter, the bank, if in this situation, would need to value the company. Is the value going to come in a little bit lower than maybe it might come in if you hire an investment banker and have an auction, you know, create a lot of FOMO and everybody wants the company?
You're exactly right. So if you're ready, willing to go through the process to go, you know, investment banking, private equity, you will very likely get a much higher multiple. An ESOP process, you are going to get a much more modest multiple. But I think that the really fun thing to do is to calculate the net after tax deposit into your bank account, whether you get a high multiple taxed or a lower multiple untaxed. You would be very, very surprised at how those numbers turn out.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. And if your kids are in the business, there may be, you know, benefit for them to just, you know, keep on building because yeah. they own it.
Yeah. But again, those are like, those are one of those things that you have to be thinking about early. It's not that you have to decide early, but you really would not be a good candidate for an ESOP if you didn't have an executive team or a management team that was prepared and ready to kind of take the torch and run with the company. It could be your family, but it could be somebody you've been grooming for a while. If you hit the point of exhaustion, you say, hey, I got to get out of this thing, but I don't have anybody to really kind of pass the torch to. Well, now there's a delay, right? Now you need to find somebody or choose a different path. So, but those are a couple. QSBS, ESOPs, those are some. Every business owner wants to talk about tax. I mean, we're not tax advisors. I feel like all we do is talk about tax. How can I offset my capital gains? How can I not pay taxes? Should I move to a different state? What if I moved to Dubai? I mean, it gets very creative and exotic, but yeah, I know anytime I sit with a business owner and I start talking about investments, I'm going to see their eyelids start to lower. As soon as I say, oh, and there's a way that you cannot pay tax, they lean in, their eyes open up. What? Tell me more about this. This is what I want to talk about.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, so one more question on this. What do you see in the economy? Now, we're recording this on, I think it's June 9th. Is it the 10th? 9th or 10th?
9th.
9th, yeah. So it's the 9th. There's some IPOs that are on the horizon. There's three big IPOs on the horizon. We got SpaceX, we got Anthropic, we've got OpenAI, and these are enormous valuations. And so it's going to suck up a lot of liquidity to get in, if you want to get into one of these IPOs at these huge valuations. What is that going to do if you're advising me on, you know, investing? What is that? What is the IPO factor going to do to the rest of my portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say, right? I don't know that there's a right answer for that. I do know that a lot of people think that IPO shares are accessible and they are very difficult to get. When I was at JP Morgan, we really didn't offer IPO shares to anybody unless they had 25 million with us. Mm-hmm. I think at Wells Fargo it was maybe 10 million. Even now at Raymond James, I literally just this morning had a client email me saying, hey, you know, SpaceX, Anthropic, like I'm really interested in this stuff. What are we doing with this as it relates to our portfolio? And my response was, we're not doing anything with it because we don't have access to it.
Can you point them in the direction of like the secondary market?
Well, yeah. I mean, as soon as it hits the public market, we can go buy shares of it, which is what I told this particular client. I said, hey, as soon as it becomes available, if it's something you want to own, I'm happy to go add it to your portfolio for you. But knowing that a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this podcast, I think that it would probably benefit them to know that those are really not available to many people. Right. It is difficult to get IPO.
I got
shares.
In on the Facebook IPO Morgan, at that time I was dealing with Morgan Stanley, and I think they were underwriting the deal, and they got an allocation for their clients.
It went down. Yeah.
It ultimately went up. Yeah. It went down right after that, but it obviously it did well, really well.
I actually use Facebook as an example because Facebook, once it hit the public markets, went up, and then it came down pretty significantly. Mm-hmm. I want to say it came down to like 24 or 22 or something like that. And then you're right, like it has obviously done tremendously well since then. But I think there's this like misconception that, oh, if it's an IPO, it's going to do well. That's not always the case. I can show you a dozen different scenarios where company IPO'd, share prices below the IPO price. So I think that, you know, I think what that is really representing though, like to kind of get back to your question, is private companies are staying private longer, right? They're waiting to IPO. They're letting their company kind of grow and evolve before they go to the public markets. And with that is going to come much higher valuations, much higher multiples. So it kind of feels like this might be the beginning of the norm, right? Where companies are saying, hey, you know, we're going to postpone going public and we're going to continue to grow this thing and stay private longer And then make a big, big jump into the public market.
Yeah, I heard SpaceX is like going to be like 100 times earnings or something like crazy. That's what their valuation is going to be. It's interesting. But I was thinking, you know, there's market volatility now. And I wondered if people were positioning themselves so that they're more liquid so they could take advantage of getting in on some of that, whether it be the IPO or right after the IPO, get it. I just want to have some allocation to SpaceX, Anthropic, and OpenAI. So I'm going to sell my Bitcoin or, you know, whatever else I've got, maybe take some profits and reallocate it.
Yeah. So something that we exercise with our clients across the board is let's have some access to some dry powder. Mm-hmm. In a lot of portfolios, we just represent that with fixed income, right? So we may have a client who's very growth focused. They can take on a lot of risk. They've shown this to us. We don't think there would be any issues with a full stock portfolio. And we may allocate like 20% towards fixed income, given where multiples are in the public markets. At a correction, right, a 10% pullback from a recent high, we get on the phone with those clients and we ask them, how are you feeling about this? Do we think it's going to go further? This is our view on it. And at the point that it kind of reaches our target, that's a great opportunity for us to sell that fixed income and go in and buy equities. And that can be done either just within your portfolio rebalancing or by having some cash on the side or rotating out of other positions like Bitcoin.
Okay, so I want to ask you about fixed income just for a second here, because I'm imagining somebody sells their company. I'm just going to pick a round number. They've been taking $1 million a year out of their company in distribution. And so then they sell their company, get a nice exit. And hey, wow, I don't really have that much cash flow now, but how am I going to replace that, you know, $1 million a year? Mm-hmm. So I want to maybe have some of my money in fixed income or something that sort of helps offset the fact that I don't really have any money coming in. I don't want to be diving into the principal to pay the bills.
It honestly, Mark, it depends. It just depends on the client. Like there are no two conversations with clients where it goes the same way. We might build a portfolio and we do a lot of private investments, right? Alternatives like private equity, hedge funds. There's a lot of stuff in infrastructure, data centers, compute. But we may take a portion of their assets and put it into like private real estate, right? And use that as our income source. Some of those strategies are phenomenal, where your income is basically a return of your initial investment. So the tax is like nothing, right? You're just reducing your cost basis. You can do it with fixed income. You can also work with a client and say, hey, you want growth. Let's stick with our growth component, which are equities. And we can sell and transfer income to you on a regular basis. Over time,
yeah, makes sense.
Over time, your growth portfolio is going to grow. Your fixed income is preservation of capital and income focus, right? So a lot of our clients being business owners, they're pretty aggressive. They're not so interested in conservative, right? They want to see their money grow. They want it to grow. And so I think it's more common for us to set up something where, hey, let's really focus in like private equity and hedge funds and infrastructure, data centers, public markets as well. And we'll just transfer out whatever that income is for you. Of course, it's always accompanied by a financial plan with our certified financial planners to make sure that it's attainable. But it seems like in so many different ways in finance, there's always more than one way to skin a cat. There's a different way to approach everything.
Okay, one more question on that. So that, you know, a lot of people are concerned about inflation, and you know, we have these different forces that we don't really know what the productivity gains are going to be versus the amount of money we're printing as a nation. Is there a thought that maybe some emerging market bond funds or bonds might be a better way to get some of that, I don't know, cash flow, if you will, versus
yield.
Like put it some yield versus put it in a bond in the U.S. where we're concerned that interest rates are going to go up to fight inflation?
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely go emerging markets. You can go high yield, right? Mm-hmm. You're sacrificing credit quality. You're taking on more risk. You're investing in a country that is probably very dependent on some kind of export. So I think it has its place in portfolios. But again, like to better service the entrepreneurs who listen to this, it is a complement to your overall strategy, right? It is never a let's go put all our money in Bitcoin. Let's take all of our money and go put it into an emerging market bond because it pays better. You have to blend it out. I actually think inflation is a very interesting topic. For many months, I've been saying, hey, the rate cut thing sounds like, I don't understand how this is going to happen because prices are clearly going up. If inflation goes up, they cannot cut rates, right? They just can't. Like, they will have to increase rates to combat inflation. That's their tool to do that with. And we just got our first inflation reading where it was going down and it just ticked up. On top of that, we just had a jobs report come out that just blew it out of the water. It was like 3x what it was expected to be. And so it also puts our Fed in a position to further consider, like, oof, there might be a need to increase rates. But we have a new Fed chair, and that's a completely different personality type. We'll see how that changes from Fed chair Jerome Powell. This is a very fun and exciting time to be watching this happen.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. So let's maybe just one couple more questions, and we'll kind of I'm gonna use this opportunity to these last few questions pivot to patriotism. And when I use the word patriotism, what comes to mind for you?
Well, for me, it's my great grandfather. He was like a general. I mean, he was a really, really big deal in the army. I remember going to his funeral, and it was, I mean, there were so many people. It was so impressive. So he served, my grandpa served, my granddad served. It kind of stopped there, but I think that they're so underappreciated. The people that go and sacrifice their lives, their time for our country. Really, I mean, all of the freedoms that we have, all of the opportunity that we have, right? The ability to start a business is because we have such a great country. I love this country. I think that it's extremely unique, but none of it would be possible without all of our military and all of our veterans out there putting their lives on the line for us. I have my daughter has a friend on her swim team that we recently got to know. And I noticed that her mom always brought her to swim. And we like got to know them. They're now kind of like really good friends. And I found out that her husband is away serving and has been gone for months. And so it's not just them sacrificing. It's the families that are sacrificing. It's the missed moments with the kids, right? The tooth comes out and dad's not there or mom's not there. I think it is so underappreciated what these people do for us.
Yeah, I agree.
Your son served, right?
I think my son served. Yeah. My son, he got shot in the leg in Afghanistan. He got a Purple Heart. And I think it's like 1% of people in the military actually see combat, right? Mm-hmm. So it's most of them are doing other jobs, which is still a major sacrifice. Yeah. But most of them don't see combat. And of those, only a fraction of them actually get wounded or injured. Mm-hmm. It's like a 0.1% or 0.04% or something like that. So yeah, it's the few, right? It's those few people. I think anybody that serves is a hero. We appreciate you. But I agree, the families that have people, like right now, there are people, today, again, this is going to air in a couple of weeks, but we had an Apache shot out of the sky apparently today. And so there are people over there in harm's way right now in Iran and in other parts of the world that, you know, how do we say thank you? Not just to the people that are over there, but to the families that miss them and are worried sick about these people.
Yeah, there's a ripple effect, right? Yeah. It's the parents, the siblings, the friends. I mean, it goes on and on. So I think that what they're really sacrificing, and this is, you talk about wealth and money and, you know, growing businesses, the ultimate wealth is time, right? It just is. If you could have more time, people would pay for it. You can't. But for somebody to sacrifice their time and leave their country and leave what they know and their relationships and go dedicate that time to making sure that everybody else here is safe and that we live in the country that we live in, like, that time is a huge commitment, right? It's a huge sacrifice. It's extremely impressive. I don't know how they do it.
Well, thank you. We feel very similar to one another on that front. And, you know, my sign out on the wall says entrepreneurs are the heroes of the American economy because they do take the risk. They do make incredible sacrifices. But it's nothing like the people that put their body on their line or their life sacrificed for the good of, you know, so that we can build businesses and have the freedoms that we have. So,
yeah, no, I agree.
So thanks for coming on the show, Brad.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a great time.
Thank you. And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.